Hey, y'all, if you enjoy watching your podcast, which seems kind of weird, watching your podcast, but some people really enjoy that. So we have a YouTube channel. You can find it at Heather Parady, P-A-R-A-D-Y. It's also linked up in the show notes. You can hit subscribe. And several of these interviews are actually in person, so you can watch that. Again, that is at Heather Parady on YouTube. Steven Bernstein is a screenwriter, director, and cinematographer. He has shot many landmark films, including the highly acclaimed Like Water for Chocolate and Oscar-winning The Monster. He's also shot iconic comedies like White Chicks, Waterboy. He wrote and directed the award-winning film Decoding Annie Parker, starring Samantha Morton and Helen Hunt. I mean, I could keep going. This guy has been involved in over 50 films. Why? He loves storytelling. And today, he is here to tell us the ins and outs of becoming a more impactful storyteller. I first ran across his work over on Instagram, where he is generously sharing his years of knowledge to not just filmmakers, but really for folks in any creative discipline. Today, he shares with us his creative process, the way he thinks through developing ideas, why he's passionate about not adding structure in too soon, how we should think about beginning and ending a story. So if you geek out like me over the creative process, you're gonna love this conversation with the very talented Steven Bernstein.
I never begin with story. That inhibits me. I have to discover meaning, and I can only discover meaning through the process of writing. If you're trying to quantify everything to fit within a preordained structure, then you're limiting potential meanings because you are presuming that everything that is to be known, you know already. Central dilemma is that we are result-oriented. And if we're result-oriented, we're not open to discovering truths to which we are not already cognizant.
All right, Steven Bernstein, screenwriter, director, cinematographer, and I wrote down here, and I don't know if you identify with this or not, but I said content creator. Yeah. Because that's how I found you is on my home base Instagram, where you are putting out consistent, incredible value for folks who are interested in the film industry, entertainment business, but I would argue just good creative process, you know, direction for anyone in whatever field. It's an honor to have you on. You have already read your bio. You've done some really badass stuff throughout your career. So thank you for taking time out of your day to join us.
No, my great pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, you might not be thanking me later because I have a whole bunch of, like I said, in the weeds, nerdy questions for you.
I love talking. So carry on.
Let's go. All right. So first of all, I wanted to just give a little background of your story. I believe you wanted to be a writer first. You ended up even moving across the sea to pursue writing as a young man. So if you wouldn't mind just kind of giving us a little bit of direction of what you thought your career was going to be and where you've landed now.
Yeah, no, the whole creative process thing, I guess, is what we're going to touch on. But I was probably too young to be fully cognizant of why writing and creative expression was so important to me when I was young, but it was important. I started writing when I was very, very young. Awful poetry, awful prose, and was reading a lot as well, an inordinate amount. So it seemed that my natural direction would be towards literature and towards writing. Mm-hmm. Went to the UK, as you rightly said, worked at the BBC, trained in the writing and directing program there. And that was the intention. And then there was a phenomena that occurred in the UK, which was music videos. And because I had access to equipment, because I knew how the technical side of film production worked, I was utilized. And I would bring the cameras, and I learned something about lighting at the BBC because they feel to be a good director. And we'll talk about this in a moment, I guess. You really have to be in command of several different languages related to the expression of your art. So it's not just writing dialogue. It's not just directing actors. It's also how to compose shots, how to move cameras, because really they sound like technologies, but they're just languages unto themselves. They're a different way of expressing. So the BBC, in their wisdom, said, well, you can't really express yourself as an artist or as a director unless you understand how the camera works creatively. So because I had that skill set, I began shooting music videos. Wow. music videos were the big phenomena then, you know, from Duran Duran to Bob Geldof to Paul McCartney, mm-hmm. you know them all. And it was a great time to be working in that particular genre because you could experiment. There were no mistakes in music videos. Everything was a motif. So if, as I did, I shot an entire video out of focus, it became a really famous music video yeah. because people talked about how you didn't have direct access to the artist. It made you ruminate on things profound. And why not? Because it was only 3 minutes. The artists were themselves experimenting. And if you could experiment, you could discover new avenues of expression. And that's why music videos at that point was so important to me. And then changed my whole philosophy about how I understood art, how I understood writing, because it wasn't just about writing dialogue. It became about how you would compose shots, how you would light them, how you'd use production design, how you use editing. Everything became an understanding of language. And if you understand language, you can understand creative expression.
Yes. So you ended up, I want to say, tell me if I'm wrong on this, loving it enough or, you know, getting enough opportunities where you spent the next several years primarily as a cinematographer. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, I had, it's funny the way our lives acquire a direction very often is to do with what validation we get or what reward or financial reward we get. So we may think that we want to do something and then suddenly we're being paid for something. So I had acquired or developed a certain style. People liked it. And first I was doing lots of music videos, high-end music videos. And then it was commercials. Most famously, I worked with Tony Kaye, Ridley Scott. Tony and I won the Cannes Golden Lion several times. And then I acquired a certain notoriety and that led to feature films. And then in a few years later, of course, as you know, I shot Monster. Monster won the Oscar, Charlize Theron. I shot big action films like SWAT, Murder 1600, big comedies, the Adam Sandler comedies, White Chicks with the Wayans. And things strangely in our lives acquire a momentum that we don't always intend. And that's kind of the direction my life took.
I had people who know me get sick of me telling this story because it was just a really pivotal point in my life where I sat next to somebody I really respected on an airplane and they're doing something that I want to do with my life. And I, poor person, they regretted sitting next to me, but I just railed them for the couple of hours we were on the plane. And one of the things that he told me is he said, I had such a strong plan for something and life just started hinting and pointing towards other things. He said, Heather, pay attention to what's working and follow that. And I'm a little torn on that advice. And I'm curious because you alluded to it. When you have a nudge and an ambition towards, let's say, writing or whatever, and then you develop a skill set and it starts getting validated, that Jim Rohn quote says, make a life plan or somebody else will make a life plan for you. Where's the balance and line between like those hints of the universe, like that man was telling me on the airplane, versus getting distracted off of what you feel like your real calling is?
Central to my philosophy in all things now is this understanding that life is chaotic. It is chaos. The idea that there is a order that is divine and ostensible, two very different and significant things, or that there's no order. I kind of err towards the no order, or at least there's no ostensible order. So if all things are chaos, if there's no code as to how we can be happy or successful or that things will resonate for us, then I think we have to be open to embracing the chaos and let life take us in different directions. Had I not been a cinematographer, I would not have become as good a writer as I subsequently became. Had I not failed at many of the things I attempted to do, independent film production, very, very hard, huge business errors that I made, catastrophic. Had I not failed in that way, had I not at least tried to succeed, I wouldn't have had the understanding, the sentient understanding of how the business works, how people work, and my own capacities. So ultimately, if we make a plan and follow a plan, we're missing the opportunity to fail. And we're missing the opportunity to fail. We're missing the opportunity to really understand how chaotic and ultimately edifying and informative the world is if we just let it take us in the direction that it will take us rather than the direction we try to impose on it. So I think that when I, for example, went on to direct actors, and I had been trained in directing actors in England, but because I was a cinematographer first, I got the chance to watch Patty Jenkins, Jon Favreau, Ridley, et cetera, direct actors. It wasn't my intention. Had I stayed with my intention, I would have been directing from the very outset, but I wouldn't have been watching other directors. By having that opportunity to watch other directors, I learned so much from their successes and from their failings. Same thing with cinematography. When I go to a sequence now and I think, okay, here's what I've got to convey to an audience. When I was simply a writer-director, I would have tried to convey it with either performance or with the writing. But now, with my background in cinematography, I will look at a sequence and realize that some of the most profound moments in a movie are sometimes when an actor doesn't speak at all. It's when you play the silences. As a cinematographer, I recognize if I have an asymmetrical composition and slowly push the camera into a face and they say nothing at all, then the audience is going to presume there's something significant. It's enigmatic, but therefore more profound by having the character not speak. But as a writer, you never do that. You use the tools that you're given or that you feel comfortable with or you've been validated for having. But only when you do many other jobs, you come to understand, particularly with the art of film, that there's many ways of speaking to an audience besides the ones that you've been specifically assigned.
So I'm jumping a little bit ahead here, but I have to highlight that a little bit because in our, you know, Western culture, and I come from more the kind of entrepreneurial space, personal development, where people are like, you have a goal and you run after it and there's a straight line and hustle and all this. And as I've been studying creativity and storytelling, and man, it's captured me. I love it. I'm so fascinated with your world. There's this like breath and space and patience that comes with it, which is so spiritual and woo and weird. And I love it. And it's so counterculture to what we as driven Americans want to do. And I'm saying that to say with this process you're saying, if I hadn't have been this, I wouldn't have learned that. It requires time and patience and space. And even in your creative process, we'll get to in a little bit about, you know, letting things take a little bit of time and not adding structure too fast and exploring a little bit more. I'm curious, as an ambitious man, someone who has goals and someone who wants to create and produce, how do you temper and balance patience with this creative process and also to moving the ball forward? Because I'm sure there are times where it gets frustrating, where you want things to move a little faster, get opportunities maybe you're not ready for. And as a, you know, I'm almost 40, but younger folks who are coming in, we want it so fast. And that's not the way life works.
Yeah, it's a couple of things. I think, first of all, you have to change the nature of your ambition. I think the purpose in life, if there is a divine purpose, is wisdom, not the acquisition of enormous wealth. I think wealth is great, and better to be rich than to be poor, there's no question. But I think to achieve that, you first have to achieve a certain amount of wisdom and insight into our shared human condition, how we all collectively function, because that means you're more likely to be successful because you understand how people are motivated, why they're inclined to support you or not support you, how, if you're directing an actor, what notes will be resonant with them and what won't be. I think it's about acceptance that you try to move things in the direction you want to move. And then when they don't move that way, you have to accept that you have to move in a different direction. One of the great obstacles, I think, to success is remaining on a course that's no longer succeeding for you. And that includes your methodology, not just your individual object. So I think there's an expression that you've probably seen me use, which is the momentum of mediocrity. That in a failed relationship, for example, and we've all been in failed relationships at one time or another in our lives, it could be a professional relationship, personal one, we tend to stay with it because it's the known. And we feel more comfortable with the known than the terror of the unknown. When we're working on a project, the project may not obviously ever going to come to fruition. Our inclination is to stick with it. And again, the virtues that we're told to identify with, to stick with something, to maintain, keep going. Sometimes the best thing you can do is abandon something that isn't giving you an individual award. Now, that doesn't mean you should give up, you know, working in film, for example, because you're not always going to be paid for jobs. You're not always going to be succeeding. But sometimes you're going down an avenue that just doesn't work. You see this with cast. Sometimes you have a particular cast person that you think is perfect. You work with them and you suddenly discover they're not right for the role. Huge decision. Do you then say, I'm going to let this actor go and bring someone else? Creates huge disruption. agents, managers, everyone's going to be on the phone to you. It's terrifying. But think about the thought process at that moment. The right thing to do is to recast. But the momentum is towards staying with the person that you had because it's easier. Staying with an idea or a person because it's easier is the thing that ultimately subverts all creative success. And it's a very difficult thing to overcome. Going back to what I was saying before about embracing the chaos, to say the known is linear and predetermined. Therefore, we're comfortable with it. The unknown, we obviously, by definition, don't know. To embrace the unknown and know that it might take us in a direction that we can't quantify is terrifying, but I think essential.
This is why I love your content, is because you're talking about one thing, but you're talking about life. What you just shared is, like I said, applicable across so many disciplines. I want to get back through your story a little bit, and then I want to dig into your creative process. You're writing a book, right? When is it coming out?
A few books, yeah. I've got a new novel coming out, which is called AI Bergerac, which is about AI and about how a film studio that tries to replace writers with AI, which is a comic novel, which was commissioned. I was commissioned by Routledge Big Publishers to write a book about creative process, the very things we're talking about how you can take an idea from its genesis and then realize it as a writer, as a director, as a cinematographer, as a production designer, as an editor, as an artist, as a musician, what that process is of taking an idea and then taking it to a reader or to an audience, and what are the processes in between. So that's the new textbook, as it were. It's really a creative undertaking. And there's another novel, which is called Don't Date the Dead, which is, again, a comic novel, which is also commissioned. So, and a couple of screenplays. Talked about embracing the chaos. All these things are going on at the same time. And there's evidence, by the way, that people who work on a single thing are much faster at achieving that thing than people who multitask. But for me, the stimulus of working on several different things at the same time, thing ultimately informs the other, is something that I have to do. But I went off topic, sorry.
No, I'm the same way. I have four things I'm working on, and I know research shows that is not the correct way to do it, but I will continue to do it because it just feels right for me. So I feel you on that. I want to dig into your creative process here in a second, but I wanted to ask you real quick, when you were really developing your career out as a cinematographer, were you still writing during that time period? Yeah.
I was writing mainly plays. I was working in theater in the UK, doing some terrible theater shows. Again, my career has been informed by my fantastic failures at a variety of different jobs. So I failed as a writer, failed as a director, failed as a person, failed as a producer, but those provide the most valuable lessons. So now if I write well, it's all because of the experiments I did when I was writing in theater while also being a cinematographer. What's really interesting for me is the juxtaposition of all these things. I guess what I'm getting to is that I don't see an order in the chaos, but the chaos, my experience of the chaos, my life, informs everything that I do. So as I said, cinematography informs the writing, the failures inform my philosophies, my directing actors on stage in a very regimented a system in the UK of how actors should be directed, then led me to embracing improvisation, which I find a much more satisfying way of working with actors. And it goes to how it engages audience in a wholly different manner than what I was trained to do. So all these stopping places along my career, each informed where I subsequently went. But to our point, I didn't know at the time that it would subsequently have such a big value. It seemed at the time just like a failure, but now it informs everything that I do.
So much freedom in that. Now you identify director, writer first.
That's all that I do really now. I did, I guess right after I did Monster, which had a big success. Monster was a great example. Again, a lot of things we're talking about, in that everyone said to Patty Jenkins, the wonderful Patty Jenkins who directed that, and Charlize Theron, who was producing it with her, Charlize was relatively unknown at the time, that film was not going to be successful. A film about a woman serial killer, there was no precedence, there was no antecedents, was not going to succeed. Which goes to another thing that we're talking about here is why when there's an orthodoxy, when there's a prevailing view about things, ignore it, because the so-called experts are going to invest in their expertise in that orthodoxy. The 3X structure you're hearing me talk about a lot in terms of writing, that all things should be written in 3X. I think it's specious, and I think it subverts creativity, but we'll come back to that, I'm sure, later in this conversation. But for Patty, she was told it wasn't going to succeed. The thing was going to be a failure. When we finished that film, and it was very low budget, came just off SWAT, which had $100 million. I left a few days early to go shoot the film for Patty. We only had a few million. We were against the clock. The shoot seemed to be a catastrophe because we're doing like 40, 50 sets a day when normally we should be doing 4 or 5. And yet, when we took the movie around and everyone refused it, when we took it around the second time, a couple of people bought it. Blockbuster, if you remember Blockbuster Video in particular, bought it. Saying, we'll go straight to Blockbuster. We'll go because there's pretty girls in it and they're kissing, I think was their theory. We'll be able to put something sexy on the cover, and that's the way we're going to sell this beautiful piece of art. And because they were the only buyer, that's who it went to. But Patty and Charlize, with integrity of vision, said, we'll make this deal with you, but please let us have a limited theatrical release, just 2 theaters, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast. And then you can do what you will with the film. And of course, there were huge queues around the line in New York and Los Angeles. It went on to be reviewed on Siskel and Ebert, gave it 2 thumbs up. They were then interviewed on Charlie Rose. It became a national phenomenon, and the film took off. The orthodoxy said the film was going to fail. It became a huge success. So all the information about how they should do the film, they ignored, and they succeeded. Anyway, at that moment, having shot that movie, went on to win an Oscar, I got a lot of attention. And a lot of people who looked at my career path said, hey, you were trained as a director. We know you've been writing. We know you've been doing theater pieces. What about directing? So I wrote a screenplay with my son about cancer, which is very important in my life, called Decoding Andy Parker. The scripts got a lot of attention. It wasn't a traditional structure. I didn't follow the orthodoxy. But when Helen Hunt read it, and when Samantha Morton read it, and Aaron Paul read it, and Bradley Whitford read it, all on a first pass, all said yes, all agreed to be in the film. And suddenly we had this enormous cast on this film that was about cancer. Again, not a topic that you would think most people consider highly commercial. And yet it raised millions for cancer charities, got a national release, got an international release, won a bunch of awards. And Mary Claire King, one of the subject matters of the film, as a result of the film in part, got the Presidential Medal of Science. And Parker became a cause celeb, and a case went to the Supreme Court. All kind of built in part around this film, or we were part of a movement, hugely significant. And that led then to rush forward to Dominion, which is about Dylan Thomas, my friend John Malkovich, which came out shortly thereafter, and then my new film, GRQ. So everything I've done since Monster really has been about writing and directing, which is where I began, but so informed by all these other experiences. And the director I was in 1978 is a very different director than I am now.
Yeah. I'm glad you ended there, because that was actually the beginning question for your creative process, is I wanted to start with just picking an idea. Decoding Ann Parker, you had this topic that you said just now you were passionate about. But I don't know about you, as a creative person who's always like fishing and looking and curious and interested. I'll tell you what, I have an idea just constantly popping in my head, like this, that. And I'm curious, as you become seasoned and really understanding an idea that is worth pursuing or not, when you have different storylines and topics you're maybe passionate about, maybe it's cancer, maybe it's, you know, school shootings, whatever, something that tugs at your heart, you're dedicating a huge chunk of your life to follow and trust that idea. How have you learned which ones are worth pursuing, and how do you pick?
Well, tough question. I don't know which ones are worth pursuing, but you're compelled to pursue them. Something that stimulates and excites me and that I enjoy is what I pursue. Ultimately, it's got to be for me. Often people come to me and say, if you do a film about this, it's going to make a lot of money because there's a lot of interest. And I can never go that direction because there's no passion or interest there. Yeah. By the same token, you mentioned story. I never begin with story. I think, again, that inhibits me. For me, going to this nature of my understanding of the world is chaos, I have to discover meaning. And I can only discover meaning through the process of writing. So if you begin your process with an outline, I feel that you can never write well. If you begin with a three-act structure, you will never be able to write well. If you begin with the story that you want to tell, you'll never be able to write well. I think Joan Didion once said she writes to discover what she means. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's exactly what I do. I begin with automatic writing. I have a microphone, it does voice recognition. I will have a general notion as to what I want to think about, and I'll begin dictating. And I will do, my rule is 10,000 words a day, which is an enormous output. But it's complete rubbish. Don't worry. It's crap. It's terrible. It's unreadable. But I just crank it out. And then the next day, and the next day, and the next day. So, and I can write a novel, and I wrote the novella on which my new film, GRQ, is based, in, I think, a week and a half. The new novel that I just mentioned, A.I. Bergerac, I think I wrote that in about a month. And it's 600 pages, single-spaced. Rubbish. I got to tell you how awful this stuff is. But
yeah.
In going back and rereading it, I discovered what I didn't know I was thinking. It's like channeling. You come to an understanding of something that you couldn't possibly have had if you didn't try to first express it. Also, the characters acquire individual voices. I'll write whole dialogue with no intention whatsoever. The characters will just be speaking to each other, and suddenly I'll discover who they are. Now, let's consider the opposite of that. Let's say you do write a screenplay following the three-act rules and with a structure with an outline. Now you know where your characters have to get by a particular time. And you know they have to say certain things by a certain page. So now, are your characters speaking naturally? Or are they speaking in the service of the structured narrative and getting that exposition out by a particular page so you can move your story forward? We don't speak that way. We don't interact that way. We go off on tangents. I've been doing all morning with you. I'm so sorry. But we go off on these tangential conversations. We have predispositions, obsessions. We're thinking about our wives, our children, our careers, our successes, our failures, our pasts, our futures, our imaginations. That's the way our minds work. And that's kind of the way our conversations work. We don't have a clear direction as to what we want to achieve by the end of a particular discussion. We think we are, it's a business discussion, we gotta close the sale, okay? That's fair enough, that's transaction. But in ordinary relationships, our psyche is much more complicated than that. And to reflect that in our writing is to show people as they are rather than as we need them to be to create an ordered structure. So when you look at great directors like Mike Leigh, for example, who works specifically around improvisation, does lots of improvisation, sometimes a year of improvisation, like he did with Sally Hawkins on Happy Go Lucky. And only then, having had all this improvisation, do they sit down and write the script. But then the dialogue is so much more natural and organic, something that we can identify as having verisimilitude, something that seems like something from our own lives, and therefore has much more impact than something that follows a careful, ordered structure. It's this freedom of automatic writing, of discovery through writing, that I think is the secret of all great creative expression. The best directors and writers I know use it, Charlie Kaufman, many others. Doesn't mean you don't end with a structure, but I think it's backwards to say you should begin with the structure. It's structure you arrive at first having discovered your ideas through the process of writing.
I'm going to confess something to you. I'm going to be fully transparent. And I wrote this down here. When I heard you teach this, and I've heard rumblings of this in Stephen King on writing, he talks a little bit about that too, of, you know, don't come up with an agenda, you know, be open and spill things out, and then you find stuff through the process. And what rubs me and what is I'm finding so much resistance, which is a key. There's something there with that. I wrote down that so anti-efficiency, because as somebody, again, back to our culture and back to, you know, production, it seems as though it would be easier to get something across the finish line when we start with something that we know that works, as opposed to, quote, and here's where my ego comes in and I have to really work on this. When I go to the coffee shop and write for 3 hours, I feel like I need to have something to show for that at the end of 3 hours, where it was a, quote, waste of time, other than allowing myself the space to throw up on paper and then throw it all away. I'm curious how you overcome that mental narrative of this needs to go somewhere, because yeah, you have deadlines, but also too, when you start with just kind of an open field, sometimes it feels like you're not moving the ball forward. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. It's brilliant. And it goes to so much of what's important in this discussion. Yeah, I think that's exactly what the central dilemma is that we are result oriented. And if we're result oriented, we're not open to discovering truth to which we are not already cognizant. And I think the majority of the truths that can be available to us are not available until we let ourselves be open to free expression and free experience, two related things. Mm. Free experience is drinking, taking mushrooms, going on a trip, whatever you do. When you go to Europe suddenly, let's say you're going to go to Europe and you haven't been to Europe, and you think you know what Paris and Milan and Florence are about, but you haven't been, but you've read books about them, so you think you know what they're going to be about. But when you land in Paris and you begin walking through the streets and go to the Louvre and you go to the Champs-Élysées and you go to the Tuileries and so on, suddenly your experience is entirely different from what you imagined. Entirely different. Mm-hmm. Traveling is the equivalent in my mind, to writing, which is you think you know what you're going to experience by reading the tour guides before you go. But until you have that visceral experience of the city, you can't possibly know it. And it will suggest understandings and insights into life there that you could never have had simply by imagining what it was going to be like. Mm-hmm. When I write and I begin having a character begin a long monologue about why they're unhappy, I have one monologue in my new novel, which went on for about 60 pages, I think, of someone who wanted to be a writer who was driving an Uber, and about his frustrations and his jealousies of other people getting in the car. And then I suddenly realized about how, as I wrote, that sometimes we misdirect or redirect hostile energies. So he was obsessed with people dirtying the back of his Uber, and he was becoming incredibly angry at the people riding with him. Now, why was he doing that? Because he was angry that he was a failed writer. But I never would have thought of that had I begun with an outline and say, I've got to take this guy from A to B. I've got to say these things, and I've got to do it within this order. It wasn't until I gave him a voice that I discovered how he had parts of me and parts of people I knew within him, and how I went in an entirely different direction. I think structure is convenient and orderly and appealing and seductive. But I think it runs contrary to facilitating our greater creative selves. If you, and I don't know, your brain's very, very good because you've always got a very sharp mind, but if you were just sit down with a microphone, get the computer out of the way, because again, anything that's mechanical is going to interfere, and just create a character and just have them speak for an hour and see what you come up with, I bet that character ends up being a lot more compelling than a character you plug in to a pre-existing script. I teach a lot of writers, a lot of students. And when I say to them, describe your story, they can go on at great length. This is where the climax is going to be, and this is going to end there. So, okay. But this is all about people and characters, right? Yeah, okay. Now tell me, for the same amount of time, 20 minutes, about your character. Tell me about them. They can usually go about a minute, and then they run out. They can say, the character's going to do this, and they do this. I go, what about their childhood? What was the first time they fell in love? What's their greatest fear? What's their greatest failing? What do they really want beyond what they seem to want within the story? What's the relationship with their parents? What do they feel about having children? And nobody can answer. I'm saying, you're writing about people and characters. You're giving insight into the human condition, and you're not making your characters human because you're not examining who they actually are. You're just telling a story about archetypes. And archetypes are interesting. That's why people like to watch football, people in helmets running around whacking each other. It's an archetype for the human struggle. But do you really know those people? And I'll tell you this about supporting your home team. When you know the backstory about those players and who came from poverty and whose brother died in a car accident and who had a terrible injury, then suddenly you feel a special connection, an empathic bridge, because you know their backstory. So do you only care about who wins the game? I would suggest that if you're rooting for your local hometown team, it's the backstory that fascinates you. So that's what you should focus on. So when you do the automatic writing, you begin inventing complex characters from your sometimes unspoken understanding of other people's human conditions. I'll say something else just very quickly. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a great book where he examined the idea of intuition. And what he discovered and what researchers discovered is that the human mind can't hold a lot of data. It holds a lot of data, but it can't hold everything. So what it does is it takes experiences and it passes it to the limbic mind, the chemical mind, rather than the sentient cognitive mind. And it stores those. So when you go by a hot stove, you don't have to go through the mental process of saying, hot stove, put my hand on it, I'll burn my hand, I mustn't do that. It sees a hot stove and it knows automatically, don't go near it. That's intuition. He tells a story at the beginning of the book about someone who's presented at a museum with a forgery of a piece of art. He looks at it and his intuition tells him it's a forgery. But when he thinks about it, all the data that says it's real, he says it's real. It ended up at MoMA. 3 years later, they found out it was a forgery. His intuition was correct. I think accessing that intuition, the non-intellectual, the unspoken, the things that are buried deep within our unconscious minds, what we're aware of, we can only access when we do this kind of creative expression like automatic writing. And when we do that, we find a voice within us that is greater than the voice we think we have. But we can only do that if we free ourselves of structure and open ourselves to the chaos and to the intuitions and the insights that our mind secretly holds as a treasure trove within.
You ready to go a little deeper? I want to go. This is why I'm fascinated by this world, is because instinctually I feel like there's just something so empty in what I've been doing for the past several years with like heavy structure and order. And even though we get a lot of shit done, there's just like no life and no spirit and stuff. And so my intuition, I think, has been overread so many times with my logic and my personality to get stuff done. And I'm trying to tap back into that intuition to hear that still small voice. And this process of dumping out on paper and creating space is beautiful. And that's a process. I'm curious what when you're looking at it and you're revising it and you're picking what's going to stay and what's going to go, how do you grow and tweak that intuition and let it override some of your logic? Because it may make sense to keep some things. Is it just a practice thing with you of listening to your gut, or has there been a way that you've developed that?
Well, it's two different stages. The first one is all gut. It's just right, no judgment. The other thing is I hate to be criticized early in the process. My wife, Carolyn, reviews everything that I write and she edits everything that I write. But I once made the mistake of giving her something very early in the process, and she was very critical of it. And then I was thinking throughout what she had said and my reaction to it and our relationship and everything else, and it affected the process. So now the way I work is that this first stage, I do the same thing with cinematography, by the way. I will just play with lights madly. And famously, I changed the whole lighting style and it became my sort of signature because I violated all the orthodoxies again through this intuition. But the first stage is all about intuition. I get everything down. The second stage, as I go back, I start thinking, what is this character about? What is this story? Where is this story? As that becomes manifest, when I start seeing it, then I start thinking, what is superfluous? Because I realize when I discovered the central ideas, what is no longer essential ideas. So really the second stage is just about cutting things out. And then I go towards from prose to haiku, where I go extremely the other direction. How little can I leave that still has an integrity of these central ideas, which goes back to the ideas of cinematography? Because sometimes I'll think, all this long dialogue by this character, what if I just had the camera sit on their face? And rather than having the normal editing that we have in a film, which has a rhythm like music, 1 second, 1 second, 2 seconds, 2 seconds, just like music, it has a rhythm. If you violate that rhythm, it draws the audience's attention to that shot that is longer. So what if I have three shots of the same length, and then suddenly I just have a shot that holds on a character's face, and I hold it for a minute? What will happen to the audience at that moment? And does it go to the idea that I've discovered in my automatic writing that I want to express? Sure, it's full of enigma and uncertainty, but some of the best creative work that any of us do is the presentation of enigma and uncertainty. The other problem with structure and order is that we have specific purpose. And if we have specific purpose, we limit our potential meanings. Some of the greatest art, like dance, like music, when you hear the Firebird, for example, you don't think that this means this exactly, or this is this series of notes. What you feel is something emotional and visceral. When you see a beautiful ballet, you don't think, oh, this is happening at this moment. She's doing the second position at this point. They're doing the first position in the background. What happens instead is you feel a visceral reaction to it. So if you're trying to quantify everything to fit within a preordained structure, then you're limiting potential meanings because you are presuming that everything that is to be known in your film, you know already, rather than being open to discovering things. And if you know everything already,
that's so good. That's so good.
Thank you. You're going to resist the idea to be open to enigmatic expression. So sometimes the most beautiful things, there's a beautiful, just finished watching a TV series called, because I'm just going to blank out, it'll come back to me in a second, just last night, and the Patricia Highsmith novel, why am I going completely blank on it? And Ripley. And what's brilliant about Ripley is that there's so many sequences in it where the characters don't say anything at all. And the architecture and the lighting and the camera movement make us feel that something significant is happening, but we can't quantify it. If we were to write a script to a structure beforehand, we would have no space for those moments that can't be quantified because we know exactly what the scene's to do. We know what information we want to convey. So all we end up doing is conveying information, telling a story, and missing the opportunity to make that experience much more profound for an audience. When we stand on a cliff in the south of Italy and look at the ocean at sunset next to an ancient ruin, are we thinking cliff, character, town, or are we feeling something within that we can't measure? Well, that thing we feel within that we can't measure is something as artists we want to put into our art. But if we plan everything out beforehand, it's almost never there.
I feel like there's so much, for me, ego, you know, where I have an agenda for something. It's like, I think I know what will move somebody and what will be profound or whatever. We really have no idea what the hell, right? It's like them being able to interpret and be moved themselves. So again, it's just, I think, a sign of maturity in your work to be able to let go of our agenda for stuff.
Well, it's not that you're wrong. We can push buttons to make our audience respond. I think you're absolutely right about that, Heather. There's no question. And we should do that some of the time. But I think also we want to be open to discovering maybe a different way of moving those same audiences. And I think the most profound way to move an audience is with truth. And I don't mean the obvious truth, but the more profound truth of who we are as humans. So when we find through automatic writing or through creative expression, a depth and a profundity and a complexity in character, so that when an audience looks at that character, they recognize parts of themselves, then we are going to move them. But even more profoundly than when we just see a wounded puppy or whatever it is, I'm sure you're doing something more complex than that. I think ultimately all of us are lonely, all of us are terrified, and all of us are uncertain about the way the world works. When we as artists provide real insight to those things, I think we engage our audience at a whole different level, not just telling a story about sadness and triumph, but the complexity of being a human, that we're a mixture of good and bad, good intentions, selfishness, generosity, altruism, real evil, kindness, we're all those things. And when we portray characters as complex, then people can really see their own nature and characters and are more likely to be engaged at a deeper level rather than just the manipulations of ordinary story structure.
Well, I am going to hammer it. We've got about 9 minutes left and I have like 10% of my questions up here. So I'm going to just start hammering you.
I talk way too much. I'm so sorry.
No, this is so good. This is so, so good. And again, I'm just so grateful for your time and really want to emphasize your social media channels and the free content that you're putting out generously. There's so much psychology and spirit and heart in it. It's just, I've really, really enjoyed it. So thank you for that. I wanted to ask you about, okay, when we're in the, we've thrown up on, I call it throwing up on paper. I know that's a little gross, but that's what it feels like for me.
As long as you think of throwing up on paper, you got to give it, I feel as giving vents to my greater self. So that way I'm more inclined to do it. But if you wake up in the morning and say, I've got to go to the coffee shop and throw up on paper, that's probably what's stopping you from doing. I'm just saying.
Yeah, maybe. You're right. I call it just getting it all out, like just emptying myself. I mean, you've done that, and then you start finding what the story is and you start putting structure to it. I'm curious. My instinct with that is to start with the end and figuring out where it ends. And I don't know why my mind goes there. I'm very, very new to writing. I'm writing my very first script right now and all that, but that instinctually where my mind goes. But I don't know if that's productive Heather who has an agenda starting with the end, or if there's any other place that you would direct me to start.
You're spot on. What I do is I do the slop draft where I give free vent to my beautiful creative interior, throw up on paper, lots of pages. Then I go back and I read it. I identify the characters. The next thing I do after that is write backstory before I get to the story. I just want to know who these characters are. So what the characters are talking, I want to know who they are. And backstory informs every actor I direct. I write 100 pages of backstory about who that character is. So they have something to draw on and we have something to share so we can reference each things one to the other when we're talking about what the character might do. So once I have the backstory for all the characters, once I have all this stuff down the page, then I can go to the end and say, okay, where do these characters get to and where do they begin? And then I do have the sense of journey, which is individualism of growth of each character. How do they change? And then once I have those arcs, then I can say, all right, I know what the characters are. They have backstory, they have complexity, they have inconsistency. It's not only going to be about narrative. It's going to be about living, breathing, complex people who have obstacles. They overcome them, they grow, they change, and here's where they're going to get to. And then once I have the end, I can go back and breadcrumb everything that leads to that. I put clues as to where it's going to go. And then there's the pleasure of resolution, because audiences, as you know, because I know you know a lot about storytelling, love resolution. They love that things are concluded. I like things to be a little bit open-ended because I don't think we ever do fully conclude anything. But still, I know that's going to give my audience pleasure to see a flawed character at the beginning find some resolution at the end. My new film, GRQ, a guy risks everything on a crypto investment, risks his marriage, risks his home, risks everything. And we see him at enormous risk. Things go catastrophically wrong. And then there's a surprise resolution. People have enjoyed the film because of the resolution. Had I not had that there, the rest of the film would not have been as satisfying. So I get it. And that's my processes. So it's not like I don't get to where you are in terms of narrative and storytelling. I just don't want to begin there because I want my characters to have a complexity, which I think will reach deeper into the individual audience's hearts.
Beautiful. I interviewed Matthew Dix, Storyworthy. He's a performative storyteller, tells stories on stages. And
love
him. Yeah. I go to the Moth in Atlanta every month. I love it. It's the best. Yeah. And what he advises for the performative storytelling is to begin with an action. So if I'm starting my story with my Aunt Susan at lunch, me and her are in motion at lunch and I begin there. And I was curious, as I'm learning film, do you have the same instinct to begin with some kind of motion at the beginning of the film, or does that even matter?
Yeah, I'll give you my one sentence for that. Begin with mystery. We are pattern-seeking creatures. Everybody wants to recognize the pattern or have a mystery answer. This is the most important secret of all screenwriting. If you begin with a mystery, something that is unknown or withheld from the audience, they will not leave that film until they've discovered the answer to that mystery or to that question. That's all you have to do now. It can be the mystery of behavior. It can be the mystery of action. They have an obstacle. There's a asteroid hurtling towards Earth, and a scientist can't figure out how to stop it. That's a mystery. How are they going to stop it? Or it can be the history. It could be the mystery of the human condition. Here are two people that are incompatible living together, but they love each other. How are they going to resolve this? a mystery. This person's behaving, happy-go-lucky with Sally Hawkins, is behaving in this very odd, eccentric, but charming way. Why is she behaving in this odd, eccentric, charming way? And that's the most compelling mystery, which is the mystery of behavior. When you see characters at the beginning of a film behaving in an odd or eccentric way that can't be clearly understood or quantified, the audience wants to know who they are and why they're behaving that way. So that's all you need to start a story is eccentricity, mystery, curiosity, and the audience engaged with one addendum, which is empathic bridge. When the audience cares about characters, and that means vulnerability, and you have that combined with mystery, you have a film and it will never fail. By empathic bridge, it's not going to core competencies, but incompetencies. When you see a middle-aged man like me in front of a mirror and he's about to go out on a date and you see him brushing his hair forward over his little bald spots and so on and getting very nervous and straightening his tie and putting on too much aftershave, and then he goes off on a date, caught on a date with a woman who doesn't seem to like him that much, who do you sympathize with that moment? Yeah. Sympathize with the guy because we've built the empathic bridge, because we've shown his vulnerability and his humanity.
Damn, that's so good.
And if he realizes, he said to his, had a phone call just before he goes out and goes, I'm so depressed. I can't find any reason for life. If this woman doesn't like me, then I give up. Now he's at this date and she doesn't like him. The mystery, yeah. What's he going to do? The empathic bridge, his humanity and his vulnerability. Will that film work? You're damn right it will work, because you've done those two elements. So action is great and important, but action about someone we don't care about, no engagement. Action with no mystery, there's nothing that advances us to the next stage. But when there's mystery, when there's uncertainty, when there's complexity, we as an audience want answers, and we will keep watching until the filmmaker provides it.
This is like a freaking masterclass. This is so good. Let me ask you one more like kind of rapid fire question and we'll wrap up here. Going into the visual element of storytelling. So I've been playing and testing with cameras and figuring out angles and how to visually tell a story on Instagram, honestly, because that's what I have access to right now. So I've been doing these little short stories. And as I'm learning how to film it and then edit it, I've been noticing that I've been just kind of getting pulling less and less. Like I'm doing a lot less editing now and less transitions and stuff. So I kind of started off heavy. Now I'm going really, really minimal. And I know there's a sweet balance there. And I've been asking myself, what is needing to be added here visually? And I think listening to you lately, I've been rethinking that question because you present visual storytelling as its own language. It's not just a tool to what's being said. It's another medium of communication. And so big ass question, messy question, but I'm curious as looking at the visual element to my story, the editing, the camera work, how do I develop the narrative there? Because my mind goes to the tech. Maybe you can point me to a book or whatever, but I'm curious how to start seeing that as its own language and what questions I need to ask of what to add in, what not to add in. I'm very, very new with that piece. Any direction you can give me there?
Again, another great question. What I do is when I'm making a film, a feature film, in my case, but same idea, I have columns for each area. And then my philosophy is that each column has to work individually. So when I write, I've got to work out a way that my writing will affect audience, both in terms of the overweening story arc, but within an individual scene, just with dialogue. Then performance. What do I want from the actors? That has to work individually. Even if they were just miming things, how can I get the actors to work in a way that it has a profound impact on audience? The third thing then is, say, cinematography. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm writing a film and this first sequence, I've got a character who's walking down the street and they feel sad and alienated. What can I do with the camera to make them feel sad and alienated? I pull the camera way back. It's a wide crane shot and I have them very small in an enormous frame because I'm thinking intuitively. It doesn't have to be intellectually or aptly quantified, but my intuition tells me when I see a small figure in a vast industrial landscape, say it's Gary, Indiana, and they see the smokestacks and the orange sky, and there's a little figure in the foreground. Yeah. Then I'm thinking, wow, they seem vulnerable. In terms of editing, I see editing like music. First of all, speed of editing is like staccato music, rapid fire music. So I know that the audience will be more excited. So I'm thinking if it's an action sequence or something that has a big argument, then I want lots of cuts. If it's a romantic sequence, fewer cuts, probably. But then I, going to what I was talking about before, I will establish rhythms with the editing. And so where do I want the rhythm to work, which kind of puts the audience to sleep? 1 second, 1 second, 2 seconds, 2 seconds. And suddenly you hold the shot for a long time. That's where the audience's attention will go. Sometimes in editing, I'll think, you know, there's a reality to having no editing. And if you really want your audience to be tense, don't do edits. Do like Woody Allen does and hold one wide shot and have characters enter and exit the frame with no cuts. Because when you edit, the audience feels safe. They feel, oh, whenever there's an awkward moment, you're going to cut away. And therefore, I'm okay. But now when you have a moment of high tension, you don't cut away, then the audience can be very tense. I'll give you a very quick example because I know we're against the clock. But there's a film called Wait Until Dark with Audrey Hepburn. She plays a blind woman who mistakenly picks up a doll at a checkout at an airport that's full of drugs. The drug dealers come to her house to kill her and get this thing back. It's her apartment, so she's figured out how to defend herself. And the one killer who remains now is going to attack her. She whacks him on the head with a iron skillet, and he falls out of frame. Now, they shot an anamorphic widescreen. She stands up way on one edge of the frame, on my frame, right over there, okay? And she's not looking towards the area of potential action, which would be there. That's the empty part of the frame. She's looking towards the frame edge. Okay. So she's looking away from where anything may happen. This guy's just fallen down. She's whacked him on the head, and she's looking away from the action. Big empty frame. She's looking away towards the empty part of the frame, towards the edge. So because we're used in art to frames being full and balanced, we presume something's going to come to the emptiness. So right away, just with the composition, the audience is on the edge of their seat. The editing during the fight sequence, 1 second, 1 second, 1 second, 1 second, 1 second, 1 second, 1 second. She stands up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Even right now, because I'm going on so long, you want to cut. And the audience is going, yeah, where's the cut coming? And now they're incredibly nervous because the director decided not to put an edit there. And now the tension's building. Music. Music starts building and building and building. What happens in film? What's the code? What's the language? When music builds to a crescendo, there's action. The music's building, way on the edge of frame. We've had all these cuts. Now it's a long shot. She's looking away from the area of potential action. The music's building up and nothing happens. Nothing happens. But without a line of dialogue, you've got the audience in the palm of your hands. By the way, if you were writing a structured 3X of screenplay, how could you have created those feelings on your screenplay? You couldn't have, because it's not there. The process of writing that way doesn't allow it. But at that moment, the camera pans over and she becomes center of the frame. The music dissipates. The camera remains stationary. Everything's calm. At which point, the guy jumps from the right of the frame and jumps on top of Audrey Hepburn. And I've been in the cinema when that happens, and everyone in the cinema jumps out of their seat and screams. Not a single line of dialogue. No storytelling. But profoundly impactful, visceral, and filmmaking in violation of the three-act principle, but an illustration of the way the film actually works rather than the way we'd like it to work.
Damn. You are an incredible communicator. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for putting out content. You don't have to do that. There's no reason for you to spend your time. The generosity that you give your audience, as a bystander, somebody who's been quietly watching you for a while, I'm like, this is so incredibly valuable. You have a podcast as well coming out with this creative I know you have a couple of books, but the creative process book, I really want to push you to finish that because I want to read it. Do you know when that's going to be available? The name of it? Anything
you can direct our listeners to? The Filmmaker's Creative Process. It's up at Routledge, and it was due a year ago. So And they very gently write to me, "Hi, Stephen, how's the book coming? The book's finished. It's a massive tome. So I've got and GRQ is just, which has been the big thing in my life. And my new feature is just coming on. It's literally just gone out to the sales market right now. So that's been, Carolyn, my big focus. But yes, I've got to finish these books. And yeah, the podcast is called Filmmaker and Fans. I hope we can be as well structured and ordered and achieve the same things you've achieved with the remarkable thing you've done here. But yeah, I feel that as artists, like this conversation, we have an obligation to give back to each other. We're part of the same community. So on Instagram, I try to post something every day because it makes me feel that I'm speaking to other people, and I'm kind of a lonely individual, and I love to be able to hear people respond to me and engage in conversation, the thing that matters to me most, which is artistic expression.
Wonderful. All that will be linked in the show notes. Very last question for you is a question about questions. So I'm always curious with folks, what is something in your life right now? And it could be big and deep. It can be something really, really small, but something you've been wrestling with that you do not have the answer to. It could be anything. And the reason we ask this is living a life of curiosity and asking questions is a beautiful thing. We don't always have to have the answers to stuff. So what is it? What is it in your world right now? What are you questioning?
It combined things, purpose and justice. I want to believe as much as I wax poetical about the chaos of the world, I want to believe that the world is just and ordered, that our inclination and our individual momentum is towards kindness and largesse and an understanding that we're part of a greater shared community. I am losing a little bit of that sense. So then it goes to individual purpose. Do I keep working and living in Hollywood and making movies? Or do I take what we've worked to achieve, move to our beloved Greece on an island, watch the ocean, and write periodically, but stop the struggle? Because going to this, where we began this conversation, this idea of writing, expression, everything else, if it doesn't have purpose, if it's not moving the world, if it's not altering other people, then, and there's no hope for ordinary social justice or kindness, then at some point, do all of us kind of give up, step away, and say, I'll leave the fray to the rest of you. I just don't know. So we haven't decided that yet, but the struggle is becoming, you know, more difficult. And as people become more fractionalized and more tribal, it's very, very frustrating, because for me, it's about this idea of all of us part of a community. What we share is more profound than our differences one with the other, but it doesn't seem the world is going in that direction. But you know, who's to say? And we gotta keep, as we've said at the beginning, we have to keep moving forward, and we don't know what we're going to discover until it is discovered.
Well said. Steve, thank you so much.
My great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, and I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Hey, y'all. Every Friday, I send a behind-the-scenes video that I only send to my email community. I cover things like the ideation process. I share my screen and show you how I write scripts. I recently hired an IP lawyer and asked him a bunch of questions about content creation. I share my takeaways from that. This is very vulnerable, raw, and real behind-the-scenes content about being a content creator, and it's completely free. So all you got to do is go to heatherparody.com/BTS. That is also linked up in the show notes to sign up and get access to those videos.